Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
Hello there and welcome. Well, I'm feeling rather buoyant this evening. My football team won. Yes, the Navy Blues are recovering from a period in the dark depths of the wilderness and are slowly ascending the ladder into light. That's my sole comment on sport today. There seems to be a hollowness at the heart of our politics at the moment. Perhaps a hollowness in the centre, both the centre-right and the centre-left. Populists on both sides are calling for a renewed sense of politics as being concerned with the whole of the citizenry, not just those with privileged access. In both the United States, Democrats and Republicans pull towards the edges of both parties, seen in the figures of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. In the United Kingdom, Jeremy Corbyn is consistently supported by grassroots Labour Party members, almost in reaction to the third-way Blairites still influential among Labour parliamentarians. And at the heart of this discussion is what's called the trust deficit. Here in Australia, both parties have shown a willingness to trash leaders and policies in the interest of short-term political advantage. So what's happening to our democracy if the centre cannot hold, wither the system? Are we putting too much weight on the disparity that we see in our political system these days? Bernie Sanders on one side, on the left of the Democratic Party, and Donald Trump erupting in the populist middle of the Republican Party. Well, to discuss this and other topics this evening, we're joined by Professor John Milbank, the Research Professor of Politics, Religion and Ethics at the University of Nottingham, Archbishop Mark Coleridge, the Catholic Archbishop of Brisbane, who also spent some years in Rome working with the Vatican Secretariat of State, Dr. Keith Suter, the Director of Global Directions Movement and a think tank, and of course a regular media commentator on international issues. And we're also joined by Casey Chambers, the CEO of Anglicare Australia, the National Anglican Church Welfare Arm. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Well, Dr. Keith Suter, perhaps I could ask you first. When we see politicians such as Sanders and Trump in the United States and Corbyn in the United Kingdom, what are voters saying to politicians?
I think that they're sick of people trying to always compromise and be in the middle. I think there's a basic frustration with the political system and a sense of alienation. And I think that what links together people like Corbyn in the UK or Trump in the United States or Bernie Sanders is simply that they're different. They're not a part of the cookie-cutter mould that you get with so many other politicians. So they are different and they're interesting and they're media personalities. And remember that the politics is now a branch of entertainment. And so the real power is held elsewhere, and the people who really run the country don't stand for election. We've moved from a nation state to a market state. In other words, the corporations, the unions, the pressure groups, they're the ones with the power. And I think deep in their bones, the voters who may not be up on all this Philip Bobbitt theory or whatever, know in their bones there is something wrong and that voting will simply mean you elect politicians. They won't necessarily come to power.
We'll talk about a number of those issues as we go on. John Milbank, you're not only a research professor of politics, religion and ethics at the University of Nottingham, you're an active Anglican, but you're also the founder of a movement known as Radical Orthodoxy. It's attracted some international attention in both religion and politics. What's the concerns behind Radical Orthodoxy?
I suppose the basic concerns are that we have today the dominance of a completely secular ideology, and that it's necessarily individualistic and naturalistic, and therefore tends to lead to a breakdown of social justice. That would be one of our concerns. As a police journalist called Giles Fraser has recently written in The Guardian, it's very striking that we today seem to see a division between the poor world that tends to be more communitarian and religious, and kind of the rich world that's increasingly secular and individualistic. And that's not an accident, really.
Archbishop Mark,
you know, that would be the short answer, and it's one aspect of radical orthodoxy.
Thank you very much. Archbishop Mark Coleridge, the Catholic Church once, many of us could remember growing up in an era when the Church was very concerned to put itself at the heart of the political debate. Some even said it went too far with the DLP issuing pronouncements from the pulpits on occasion, or at least suggestions that the DLP was making announcements from the pulpits. But has the centre of politics in some ways been evacuated by all questions of ultimate value?
Well, in some ways, yes. But I think what's been the most dramatic change has been the change of the landscape in which power is won and exercised and lost. I think that there has been, and here I draw upon the remarkable book by Moises Naim called The End of Power, where he argues, I think very convincingly, that we are seeing the decay and indeed the end of big power, be it political or commercial or even ecclesiastical, and the rise of micro powers. So I think that there's a whole change of landscape that means that political power is easier to get, it's far, far harder to exercise, and it's easier to lose. So it's the collapse of the big powers, I think, is what's going on. And the big political parties aren't what they once were. And certainly the big church can't have the influence in public life that it once had. And with the collapse of the big and the kind of fragmentation that implies, you have the rise of these anti-politicians like Trump and Sanders and Corbyn and many, many others. But that is related to a radically changed landscape in which political power is far, far more constrained by these micro powers in a way that it wasn't in the past, even in the fairly recent past. Mm. I mean, political power is constrained by insurgents and hackers and activist groups, citizen media, and I could go on and on and on. In all kinds of ways, these new phenomena are making it much harder to exercise power. So I actually feel a bit for the politicians. I think they're being asked to do what is almost impossible. Certainly the expectations of in this country, the expectations of the community are so inflated that no government could ever meet them. So in that sense, every government is doomed to failure. So you have these very short tenures, the changes of leaders, and more frequent elections. But it's all to do basically with a changed landscape. I don't think that the people who are our political leaders are any better or worse than they ever were, but they are in a much, much more challenging and difficult situation.
Casey Chambers, you're somebody who spent your professional life dealing with the consequences of political power, particularly the consequences of the exercise of social policy, a major instrument of political power. What's your view on the nature of the way the system is changing?
Well, I think one of the things that we see really clearly is that there is a greater number of people who are seeing that they don't belong. They don't belong to the society. They're not cared about by the community. We see it through people in insecure work, people living on the periphery. Housing affordability is a big issue. There's a lot of people who don't feel like they belong. And it's my view that you need to feel you belong in order to take responsibility, and you need to take responsibility in order to care politically. So I think there's a really direct line there between those. Social policy, of course, is the instrument which we can use to change whether people feel like they belong or not. But at the moment, it would be our view in Anglicare that we see more and more people who don't behave like they belong and who aren't given a sense of belonging. I think there's a number of reasons that we can talk about why that might be happening. But certainly, we see people are losing their connection to the greater Australian community. They might be staying more connected in terms of electronic communities or small communities, but that sense of belonging to a neighbourhood, to a community, to a group of individuals, the sense of a greater good, I think, is greatly lacking. And I think that then destroys trust, but also destroys our reason for feeling responsible and feeling that we might want to vote and that our vote might actually have an effect.
Keith Souter, Casey Chambers is alluding there to concepts that go back to the 18th century, to to Rousseau and the nature of the social contract. That is, society is held together by an agreement about the limits of the exercise of power.
That's right. So the old idea was simply that on the one hand, people would agree to be citizens of this newly invented entity called the nation state. At the same time, the nation state would have to deliver services. So that was the contract. So what we have seen, I think, over the years is that governments are delivering more welfare. But obviously people's expectations continue to rise. We've had a revolution in rising expectations, that whereas previous generations would be grateful for what they received, people are now becoming more and more greedy. So you give them tax cuts and they want more tax cuts. You give them services, they'll require more services, even though the amount of tax being collected may actually not be sufficient for those services, therefore governments go into debt.
Although, Casey Chambers, you may want to argue this point, I think it would be very hard to argue that there's any social justice involved when you have a New Start allowance that's around $260 a week. Casey?
That's right. I mean, I've said this many times on this program before, John, and people will be sick of hearing us say this, but it seems to us that New Start is actually a barrier to getting work. We see people for whom day-to-day survival has to come before getting work, and when you haven't got enough money to put food on the table, to pay, you know, to go to a dentist, to get doctors' attention, to do the myriad of things that are actually part of being part of a democracy and of a community, then really those things, they're not going to drive you into getting work and into participating. So certainly you handed me a real Dorothy Dixer there, John. You know, there can be no social justice when we're saying that is that low. And I think what's interesting is how many people actually fight against it being there. Maybe not at all, but people seem to think it's too much. Now, we have some evidence at Anglicare that people think it is higher than it is, so that's why we do harp on and tell people how much it is. But realistically, to live on $13,500 a year is pretty darned impossible.
Archbishop Mark Coleridge, at the centre of even this brief discussion we've had, this sense in which society is fraying at the edges, the central issue seems to be an issue of trust. That is, the big end don't trust the small end of town. The small end of town don't trust the big end of town. And the centre argues about distribution in ways which will advantage them and their interests.
Yeah.
What moral centre remains for us in society these days? What ethical centre?
Well, one of the difficulties, I think, with the fragmentation that Casey has mentioned is the lack of a core of shared values and the fragmentation of a moral framework that the common good presumes. I think that process has been going on for some time and is now quite dramatic. But the other thing I'd say is that governments are in a situation where now, if they do the thing that the country needs, they lose power. And therefore, the only way they can win power and retain power is not to do what the country needs. And I think that lies at the heart of what you're calling the trust deficit. That they're not, governments aren't trusted to do the thing that is necessary for the good of the nation. And yet, if the government does what the good of the nation requires, it will lose power. So there's a kind of a conundrum at work in this whole thing. The trust deficit is the result, as I say, of governments being in a situation where they are so constrained that they cannot do what governments ought to do and need to do for the good of the community.
John Milbank, you're one of those suggesting that this value sense, what builds trust at the edges, at the peripheries, to allow a centre to hold, is something that can be, or used to be at least, supplied to a large extent by religion. But how does one re-inject religion or religious values into increasingly secular societies?
Yeah, thank you. Can I first of all just slightly correct an impression about Jeremy Corbyn, because he's in no way a populist like Sanders or Trump. All his support is amongst kind of libertarians in London, slightly crossed with hard left themes. So he's an example of the power of activists within a party, but he has huge difficulty in reaching most of the population. I mean, that's just because I think there is a widespread misperception outside England.
Well, thank you
for what Corbyn is like. But if I could handle that trust issue, I think that one of the things we need to realise is that kind of trust has been almost deliberately broken down by neoliberalism. You know, that people at work are encouraged not to trust each other, to compete against each other. And very, very impersonal procedures have been put in place instead of interpersonal procedures that depend on trust. And I think there's a limit to the way these things can even work, that eventually they break down into anarchy and criminality. And I think that the promising thing is that people are starting to sort of reinvent basic human institutions. You know, you've got things like social enterprises, citizens' organizations that are precisely a more kind of interpersonal social and political approach. And in that sense, they kind of contrast with traditional left and right-wing politics, as you've already been saying, you know. And they may or may not be of religious inspiration, although I think it's incredibly striking the way all sorts of religious groups are coming back into the political sphere and the social sphere. You know, despite sometimes religious decline, they're nonetheless becoming more socially and politically activist. I think because they perceive that it's ever more difficult to live within the values of secular society. So they're trying to offer an alternative, I think. So I think that, you know, there are countervailing movements to what I see as kind of the rule of the impersonal that is trying to dispense with our need for trust and reciprocity.
Dr. Keith Suter, a lot of this has come to the fore in the years since the global financial crisis, but did not the rot begin earlier? If we're talking about our civic institutions, not so much so perhaps with Friedmanite economic rationalism or what Charles Dickens even termed the Manchester School of Economics, but when Margaret Thatcher said there's no such thing as society, and Ronald Reagan said government is the problem. Surely, for the centre of a democracy, government is the highest expression of citizenship.
Well, you would think that, but let me just give you a quick history lesson. So that in the 19th century, Charles Dickens was complaining about the sort of, if you like, the new sort of everybody making lots of money and ruining the lives of a lot of poor people. In the Depression and then World War II, the attitude towards government changed because it was because of government we were to get out of the Depression and we won the two world wars. That flowed through until about 1973. What we've seen since then, as you said, is the rise of Mrs. Thatcher, the Longy government in New Zealand, Bob Hawke, Ronald Reagan, different political parties, same viewpoint, which Professor Milbank has referred to as neoliberalism. In Australia, we tend to call it new right economic rationalism. But essentially, you look out for number one, do unto others before they get a chance to do it unto you, which means, therefore, you don't rely on government. And what you do is just to try to make as much money, look out for yourself, and that's really what counts. It goes back to Ayn Rand, you know, a long way back. And when I think paying the price for it, I've been a critic of new right economic rationalism over the decades, but that's the dominant paradigm at the moment. Until the economy collapses entirely or until we get the rise of, say, the Chinese model, which is a new way of doing government and the economy.
Pretty pessimistic and bleak outlook. John Milbank, let's me come back to you first on that and your response to what Keith Suter has said.
I completely agree. I mean, I think we have to ask ourselves why we've had this dominance of what he calls new right economics. And I think that's possibly because the old Keynesian approach was, you know, in terms of capitalism, suffering an awful lot of strain. The unions were becoming very, very powerful, but it seemed as if the market wasn't delivering enough profitability. And then you get the swing from statism to the market. And, you know, the statist model, it tries to kind of constrain the market and then have a certain amount of government intervention, welfare programs as well, and the welfare budget gets too big. And I think the question now is, you know, whether we should go for either a market or a state solution, or whether there can't be a third, more socially based solution. In other words, trying to give genuine participatory power to people, both in the economy and in society. And obviously, the state is going to be part of that. But in many ways, what we're seeing now, somebody talked about the market state, that's right. We're seeing a sort of, and maybe the Chinese model as well, we're seeing a fusion of kind of market impersonalism along with bureaucratic impersonalism. And the more interpersonal approach that I'm arguing for would be much more about what some people have called a big society rather than a big state. And trying to have a different kind of economy where people are pursuing social benefits alongside profits, and that's built into the system, maybe even legally built into the system. But it's a much more kind of dispersed solution because I think there's oscillation between a kind of Keynesian approach and a new right approach, otherwise just goes on forever. It's built into kind of capitalist cycles. To escape from them to a more just kind of economy, we need this much more communitarian approach, I think.
That approach has been suggested. I've seen that those words used on both sides of politics in Britain. We've heard of Tony Blair and the Third Way. We've heard of David Cameron and the Big Society. Politicians tend to grab onto ideas as though they're sweets in a bag, and you pull one out and you unwrap it, and all that tastes good for a moment.
They're not enough committed to them.
Archbishop Coleridge, surely here is an opportunity for the church to reinsert itself into the discussion. In some ways, it seems almost as though the church calling people back to not necessarily popping to the cathedral every day, but a sense of who we are, what has shaped us.
Yes, the only problem I have with that is the reinsert. I don't think the church or the churches can in any way long for other days when we were a much more potent voice in the public arena. Christendom is over, and it takes a lot of time to accept that fact and its implications. But I do think...
Because Christianity appears to be over.
That's a different point altogether. Christianity is far from over, but we need to engage the public arena in ways that are quite new and creative, and take account of that changed landscape, which affects us, the church, every bit as much as it does the political class.
Yes.
John Milbank, what were you going to say there?
Well, I tend to slightly question the theological orthodoxy of a big division between Christianity and Christendom, I'm afraid. I think it can be a kind of self-delusion, you know, trying to turn the fact that Christianity has lost power and influence into a good thing. I mean, I agree, there's lots of bad with...
I'm not saying it's a good thing, John, I'm saying it's a fact.
it's a fact at the moment, but I don't think anything in history is inevitable. You know, I mean, up till recently, Islam was apparently a thing of the past in the Middle East, and it has bounced back. I certainly believe strongly in the division between church and state. I don't believe in the church seizing political power, but I think the question of a dominant Christian influence is a quite different one. If Christianity doesn't dominate, something else will. And I don't think you can readily separate Christian mission from cultural influence, from trying to shape all kinds of institutions, and I think actually you would agree about that.
Yes, I do agree with that, but I think of the words of Pope Francis recently, where he said that we have to be far more concerned about creating processes than dominating spaces. And in my
I agree about that, I agree.
So new processes of engagement with the public arena that enable us to speak with an original voice, not as lobbyists or as politicians, but to resist the pressure that would push the Christian voice and the Christian presence into some private corner. That's part of the fragmentation that's going on.
I totally agree, and I would like to connect that point with the point that other people have been so rightly making, is that one of the problems at the moment is it's no longer clear where power lies. You know, it's not easy to identify it with governments or even with big corporations. It's much more subtle and dispersed than that.
Absolutely.
And power exists in a kind of cultural dominance of this, you know, individualistic anarchy, and therefore what the Archbishop is saying is absolutely right, that the way to counter that is to create a kind of alternative cultural norm, you know, which the Church can be part of along with other religions, other non-religious people, and I think this is a very different kind of politics, you know. So in some ways, labour movements started as movements, not as political parties. We need some slightly different equivalent to that, I think, now.
But I think here, too, of the words of Frank Kermode, the centre is everywhere. That's the situation we're addressing.
Yes, John, you completely right, yep.
John Cleary, you've spoken about the centre cannot hold, but there is now no single centre. The centre is everywhere, as Kermode says, and that's what we have to take account of and the world in which we have to engage differently.
Could I just make the comment that I think part of our problem is that the way the media are presenting the situation, say, in Australia or the United States, we've got elections underway, is to give the impression that we're going to make a major decision by the person for whom we vote. And so we are focusing attention on personalities rather than policies. And the really big issues are the ones that we're trying to tackle here, which are the future of the nation state, the role of religion, the importance of focusing on the underprivileged within our society. These are all issues that tend to get neglected. One of my favourites is the role of information technology and the loss of jobs. Because the society that we've got now will be very different in 20 years' time, when so many of today's jobs will have disappeared. But when I raise this, the politicians will say, "Look, I've got to win an election this year. You're talking about 20 years' time. I'll be retired by then." Yes. And that's our problem. We're so focused because the media, 24/7, focusing on immediate issues, not long-term threats to Australian society.
Casey Chambers, you're somebody who deals with politicians day-to-day to implement policy. But when you step away from the workplace and you step away from that interface, what are the profound concerns that come to you in this area? Because you must be forced to think about it all the time.
Oh, definitely. And I couldn't agree more with and I forget who it was. I'm not quite used to everyone's voices yet tonight. But the short-term nature of the decisions that we're being asked to make, and driving here tonight, I heard the current Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, talk about the choice we're going to make on the 2nd of July. And I'm not sure that is that much choice. I think the short-term nature of democracy. And I know that Winston Churchill famously said we haven't, you know, it's the least worst, least bad system we've got. But the short-term nature of it makes it very difficult. So we have politicians who are vying in what seems to me to be a kind of Facebook-type election. You know, the more likes they can get, the better. No one's actually saying, well, this is, you know, like we would say to our children, you actually need to take some bad medicine along with the good, and we need to learn some hard lessons, and we need to learn, for example, that you can't have growth, 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 and more growth. I think that rings hollow for a lot of people. So I think when some of these politicians are making these vast promises of how wonderful life will be under them, and how every day will be sugar-coated, and we'll all have wonderful internet, and we'll all get everything we need, I think there is a kernel that rings hollow for people, that everybody knows deep down that that can't be true, that growth has to be, you know, curtailed in some way. So I think there is some kind of emptiness that is more than just democratic. There is a spiritual emptiness that goes along with that, that I think we see quite often in the people that we work with. And I think in terms of the place of the church in this, I'm going to blow our own trumpet a little bit and talk about, you know, the fact that Anglicare agencies, for example, work with 1 in 26 Australians. That's an awful lot of people, and I know other faith-based networks have similar numbers. We talk about, you know, faith without works is dead. Well, this is the works that's going on with people, and people are engaging with these agencies with great integrity that they're not seeing from their other civil leaders.
At the heart of this, there seems to be, if you go to something hard and practical, and we've alluded to it, a question ultimately at the centre of our political debate about distribution and redistribution. That is, the big end of town say, distribute upwards to us and the goodies will trickle down. The bottom end of town, oh, and they also say, and we don't trust the bottom end of town because the goodies they get they abuse. The bottom end of town say, all you want is take, take, take. I slave my guts out, I get nothing for it. And when I fall out of job, all you want to pay me is a lousy, miserable wage. Why should I trust you? And there hasn't, it seems to me, been a consensus leader, and I'm talking about the United States, I'm talking about Australia, I'm talking about the UK, over the last 30 years, who has managed to build a consensus of trust across that distributive divide. John Milbank.
Well, I completely agree, and I absolutely agree about this point about the long term, but I wonder whether that isn't more to do with the inadequacy of political parties than the general population. In other words, I sometimes think there are people, things that everybody wants to get done that can't get done because of the nature of political parties. And also that if you put the arguments more clearly to people, they would listen. But the trouble is about sort of short-termism, that it's linked to the often irrelevant ideological nature of political parties and the way in which people come into power, and they only think in terms of their own short-term benefits. And I think this applies very strongly to the lack of what in Britain we would call, a one nation politics. It's been very, very dominated by sectional interests, you know, either people who are just on the side of big business. There are some people who don't want to think about the economy at all. But in general, almost everybody has gone along with some version of neoliberalism and the myths of trickle-down, you know, whereas all the evidence now shows that this just doesn't happen. If you have inequality to begin with and you don't try to redress it, it gets worse and worse. You get less and less social mobility. And it has a negative effect on the whole economy. So we lack politicians saying, look, it's in the interests of you as businessmen to have a much more socially just approach. There's no, you know, we just have ideologies, really. What one side is sort of banging on about individual free economic freedom, the other side is banging on about welfare claims. And nobody is really, there's sclerosis, really, because we need new kinds of ideological political movements.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Our guests this evening are Professor John Milbank, Research Professor of Religion, Politics and Ethics at the University of Nottingham, online from the UK, Archbishop Mark Coleridge, the Catholic Archbishop of Brisbane, Casey Chambers, the National Executive Officer of Anglicare Australia, and Dr. Keith Souter, a consultant on strategic planning and an internationalist. And a member of the Club of Rome. We should have said that right at the start, Keith Souter. Coming back into this question, and we started with trust, and it does come back in a way to trust. What will help us to rebuild the centre of our politics? If you'd like to give us a call on this, 1-300-800-222. 1-300-800-222 is the number to call, and we've got 15 minutes to take your calls with our guests. Good government. we seem to have a post-war consensus that lasted for about 30 years, as you indicated earlier, Keith Suter. We seem to be in the midst now of a period of distrust, and you referred to in your opening remarks of this isn't just about politics. It's about everything. You see, for the churches, the sex abuse crisis in Australia, in Ireland, in the USA, it's been devastating. That just has heaped coals of fire upon the decline of numbers that had been going on anyway, with the burgeoning of individualised communications like television over the years. What helps us rebuild a centre? We all agree we need to recover community, but community means coming out of your one-bedroom unit into a public space. I mean, community is something about human touching, isn't it? About human togetherness.
Well, let me just say, in political terms, you've really got three choices. You have the process of reform, which is really what we're talking about and which underpins your question. The second one is destruction, which is Islamic State, etc. A third one is building alternative communities. In other words, simply saying, look, leave the politicians to what they want to do. We will be engaged in politics, but not party politics. And that's why I think a lot of young people are involved in politics. They're not wasting their time going to political rallies. What they're doing is developing alternative ways. Grassroots activism. The new cooperative movement, particularly in the United States, to a lesser extent in the UK. There's a lot of stuff that's going on, which simply doesn't get into the main frame, because the media don't tell us what to think, but they tell us what to think about.
It's all right, there won't be media around for much longer.
Well, that's part of this change that's coming about with information technology. Yes. So what I'm suggesting, therefore, is that you do have a lot of people in Western societies who maybe have given up on institutions but just want to do things differently. They're still engaged, but they're doing it differently.
Archbishop.
Yeah, well, I think you used the word human, John Cleary, and I think that's right at the heart of it, is to focus on the human being. It sounds trite, but it's not. One of the dangers is, no matter which side of politics we're talking about, a kind of idealisation of the economy, as if the economy is a thing unto itself with a life of its own. I think to really ask the question what a genuinely human economy might look like. And one thing a genuinely human economy would require is the development and long-term enactment of policy. In other words, the move beyond that short-term phenomenon that we've discussed and the resort to mere tactics. See, that's what we're dealing with at the moment. We have tactics, not policy. And as long as we're caught up in that short-term and shallow world, I think there's no way of having a genuinely human politics or a genuinely human economy.
There's an interesting way in which both sides of politics here represent materialist answers, both left and right. And there's a way in which, John Milbank, I'll ask you, on this old-fashioned conservatism has almost disappeared. If you're conservative in current political strands, you're what would be a 19th century liberal. The old Tory conservatism, the noblesse oblige, has gone completely.
Oh, yes, I completely agree, and that there are no conservatives left at all. What we have today is a right wing defined by economic liberalism and a left wing defined by cultural liberalism. So, if you like to put it humorously, one side is about greed, the other side is about lust. But increasingly, the two things are merging. And especially, I think you see that in Britain, that the British Conservatives are also culturally libertarian. So I think that's, the old left and right in the 19th century, the right meant people who still half believed in the Ancien regime, and the left were liberals. We can now see, I think, that we're really all liberals. We're dominated by liberalism. So the question is then, you know, what you want as an alternative to that. And I think maybe this is where things get extremely paradoxical, that we need that kind of socialist sense of greater egalitarianism and solidarity and so on. But we also, in a way, need to ask the genuinely old conservative question about, you know, what is legitimate authority? You know, if today we have an elite that's only about money, as Marx pointed out, you know, what are the conditions of having a more genuine elite, I think, is a really crucial question. And in many ways, our system of government is not fully democratic, nor even should it be. It's a system of representative government. And therefore, you need to talk about how do you create decent representatives, you know, how about the people... you know, aspects of the decisions that get made are not necessarily democratic, thereby creative people proposing things. So you need to create a much more sort of virtuous and trustworthy set of people at all levels of society. So I think the solution is partly egalitarian, partly democratic, but it's also about trying to shape values in common, and having our leaders, you know, genuinely pursuing those values. And this is where it's hard to avoid something religious and metaphysical at the center of your activity. And I think to avoid merely sort of single-issue politics, we have to have something very, very holistic in the kind of manner I'm talking about.
Oh, one could idealise a meritocratic House of Lords, couldn't one?
Well, this is actually not a joke, because a lot of people in Britain favour a House of Lords reform where the House of Lords would represent different vocations. In other words, you wouldn't just have a simulacrum of the House of Commons. But it would indeed be sort of leaders, religious leaders, business leaders, union leaders, leaders in all walks of life, to sort of represent that kind of vocational rather than merely regional aspect of the life we live in common. And so, yeah, I do think and actually, if you look at Britain, the Lords are often way more sensible than the Commons, way more moderate and much more thinking in terms of the long term. So I do think that actually almost an extra democratic role is very important for thinking about the long term.
Casey Chambers, just on the communitarian thing, church agencies and, in fact, church groups of all sorts are becoming the focus of social change and social agitation. You see it in things like the Love Makes a Way movement and the defence of refugees. Mm. You see it in groups advocating for the poor and the poorest. It seems that churches are seedbeds of activism still.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's almost that everything old is new again. They are some of the most radical places to be. Our parish partnerships network that works across the country came together a couple of weeks ago in Ballina. And some of the sort of things that they do, they're absolutely radical. They're absolutely new and they're absolutely grassroots and they're absolutely what would have been happening 2,000 years ago. I think the other thing that I really just want to mention before we come up to crunch time is there was a group of church agencies and other civil agencies that got together this week to talk about the, certainly in Anglicare's view, an absolute low point in democracy in Australia. And that's been the media's view that it was in the, or some parts of the media's view, that it was in the public interest to investigate the background of a gentleman who asked a question on Q&A, and most people probably be aware of that gentleman. His background was absolutely torn apart. And, you know, the whole sort of the statement of let he who is without sin cast the first stones comes to mind. You know, if we couldn't ask questions and we weren't allowed to ask, well, why was this tax cut given here and not there? If you had to be of a pristine background to ask any question in a democratic society, then there would be few of us able to do so. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that the church agencies and the civil society organisations stood up and made comment about this and picked up on this is an example of, as you say, that kind of radicalism that's going on within church groups and within church agencies.
Thank you for that. Let's take a call now. We've got a number of calls on the board. We'll try and get through them rather quickly. To Pam in Cooperoo first. Pam, thank you for joining us. What would you like to say?
Good evening to you all. I firstly think democracy is being seriously undermined. And extreme right or left, so dangerous. And the thing is between the media, mainstream media, then social media, it is exacerbating the situation for the politicians. Even the, well, first of all, I mean, electors want always someone charismatic. Forget about pragmatism, forget about policy and the like. There's no central sort of consideration for what is good for either the country, the community, and the long-term stability.
Yes, that's a very good question. That's a point you made earlier, Keith, that the media is actually focusing on politicians as sort of quasi-presidential candidates, yep, in Australia and Britain rather than first among equals cabinet members.
That's right. In fact, what we have now in Australia is a presidential system of politics but a parliamentary system of government. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people, when you get the sacking of a prime minister, will say, well, look, I voted for that person. But no, you didn't. Only less than 1% would have had the chance to vote for that particular individual, because we have a parliamentary system, not presidential. So the media have actually confused the viewers as to how our politics operate.
Let's go to Robert. Hello, Robert. How are you? Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening to yourself and your guests. I would like to certainly agree with some of the things you're saying, and I think it's the process of democracy itself, this whole election business, which is really poisoning the system. In that, in order for people to get elected, they have to go through all sorts of processes and owe all sorts of favours to all different people. We've had things about corruption in the political donations in the last few weeks in Australia. And it is just obscene the way that these things are being manipulated.
Good. We'll take that. I'll take that as a comment, Robert, and we'll get someone to comment on that. Archbishop, the way in which politics itself, you've got to come up through a party system. Those party systems tend to be corrupted by all sorts of pressures, not just financial ones. And by the time you get into Parliament, you're sort of a bit tainted by the way you've got there.
Well, that can be true, but what I would say is that the big political parties, again, aren't what they used to be. They're being reconfigured like the big corporations and so on. So I wouldn't overestimate the power of the party machine anymore. These big party bosses who once called all the shots do not have the power they once had. They are as much constrained as governments are. So I actually think that the quality of people we have going into public life is about the same as it's ever been, at least in my experience of things here. So I don't think it's a matter of saying that they're worse or less trustworthy personally or more tainted by the political process. If anything, we're probably we're finding that people in our parliaments are less tainted by party machinations than they once were, as the real power of the big parties itself is being reconfigured or even eroded.
John Milbank, what's your reflection on that?
I agree up to a point, but I do think there's a problem with all our leaders today in every field of life, but in a way that they're lacking in honour. I mean, this isn't a personal accusation. It's just our society is so rapid and fast-changing and people are so ruthless that I think in the past, when people were more settled, they had much more of a sense of kind of long-term responsibility, knowledge of what they are involved with. And I think there's a big question about how we now try to recreate that. And I agree with the man who said that there's a problem with formal democracy now. It becomes anti-democratic. And we need sort of much more informal modes of real participatory democracy, somewhat connected to people who have a real sense of responsibility and commitment to institutions and areas. So I do think I think maybe, you know, modern media and the fact we can communicate with everybody might allow us in a very strange kind of way to reinvent regional rootedness, because remote places can keep in touch with each other. But I think for ecological reasons as well, we need much more connection back to the land, and we need to start with that if we're going to recreate somehow this sense of leaders having real responsibility and long-term vision. We need that connected with a genuinely participatory democracy.
Climate change will force us back to the land, I would imagine, focus on it.
That could happen.
We've only got a minute left, so I'm going to do a very brief, quick around. Casey Chambers, if you have your druthers, what's your number one point for the election?
Look, I think it is about people taking a long-term view. I mean, I could say it's New Start or housing affordability or whatever. But I think if people did take a long-term view, if we're able to do that, if we're able to look at what's good for all of us, not just for this community or even for this country or this region, but what's going to work for everybody, it's going to make people less popular in some ways, but that, you know, that's what's going to get us through and get us back to a more community acceptance of taking some bad to get good.
Archbishop Mark Coleridge, the Catholic bishops have put out a statement for the election as ever. Is there one point that you'd wish to highlight?
Well, its title is a Vote for the Voiceless, and I would very much like our political leaders to listen to those who have no voice.
That's as good as we've got, and we've run out of time for Keith Suter. We'll have to catch you another time. Thanks to you all for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.